Machete Mate recognizes the traditional owners of the land on which we are recording. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and any indigenous elders of other communities who may be listening today. We stand in solidarity in their struggle towards the colonization and land back. Buenas, mi gente. What is good? Machete Mate and Austinless Comrade Convo today. Going to be a really dope one, especially for the Cuba heads out there. If you want a measured sort of insider perspective into Cuba, this is probably the one for you. We're really excited about this one. But before we get into it, shout out to our new compas oficiales, our patrons, Timothy and Taylor. Muchas gracias y bienvenido a la familia. As compas oficiales, we get access to community Discord, the book club where we'll be discussing building the commune. Where it talks about the Bolivarian project and building the communes of Venezuela. You get access to our After Dark episodes, and the latest series also detailed his experiences to Venezuela with the DSA delegation. Also, you bring me one step closer to living my dream as a stay-at-home dad. So, like, this will give me, you know, an excuse that I could tell my wife that this is worth it. Anyway, look, even if you don't sign up, even if you don't, you know, donate, whatever, it's all good. We're just happy and grateful you're tuning in. At the end of the day, we're all one big anti-imperialist family. Anyway, I'm Leroy from currently locked down NARM, known to y'all as Melbourne, Australia, here with the homie T. What's good, man?
How's it going, y'all?
And joining us today, again, we're really excited about this one, Andres Peltierra, our personal favorite Cuba expert on the Twitter. Like, we were actually talking about it, how, like, that's how we, like, keep up to date with everything that's going on there. But in all seriousness, like, he always provides a very, very good measured sort of perspective on Cuba, because it's easy to fall in love with, like, the romance and get caught up with the romance or the revolution, all that stuff, but it's really good stuff that he puts out. Andres, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on, and thanks so much for your really, really kind words. I really appreciate it.
it's all good.
Thanks for doing this great show.
Thank you. That means a lot to us. But yeah, quick vibe check. How you doing, Andres? What's good? How are you feeling? How was your day? How's your week been? How's your month been?
I'm kind of tired because I'm doing this Russian intensive course. It's a year's worth of Russian in 2 months.
Oh, that's fine.
It is brutal, but I'm learning a lot, and I wrote a 166 word composition in Russian cursive this week. So I'm feeling happy about that, and I just finished writing the first draft of a Cuba piece that I'm gonna that I'm writing for a publication, which will be clear soon.
Dope. That's really dope. T, how you doing?
Oh, I'm chilling, man. I'm just super hyped to be on, you know, to do this talk. You know, like Leroy was saying, you keep it real, you know, and we definitely appreciate that. What do I complain about all the time on this show is my fucking job. So yeah. It's just this normal work bullshit. But other than that, you know, I'm chilling. I'm good. Today was, the dog's birthday. So that's always fun.
Yeah, absolutely, man. With me, same shit, man. Work's the same. Work's always going to be the same. It's bullshit. But we're in lockdown, so I'm there by myself. I can just chuck on my headphones and listen to my podcast and stuff like that and just do what I need to do, nice and chill. I'm a bit of an introvert, so not having to be in front of people all the time, it's kind of therapeutic to me. So that's fun. Also, I just remember there's actually a, speaking of Russian, there's actually a Russian reggae band where the lead singer is this Afro-Cuban whose father, like, moved to the Soviet Union, and he was born in reggae. So, like, you see this, like, Afro-Cuban with, like, dreads and everything singing reggae in Russian. I forget what their name is, but it's wild. I'll probably link it to the show notes or whatever, but it's pretty wild. It's pretty bizarre to see. But anyway, with that said, we'll get into it. So we'll do really quick headlines. We usually do a more elaborate, usually do a more of a discussion, but we'll keep it nice and brief so we can actually get into the conversation. In an update to our latest episode, Jovenel Moise's Funeral took place the other day, and it went as you would expect. Gunfire, protesters clashing with police, et cetera, et cetera. It was an absolute circus, but what else is new when it comes to Haiti, right? If you haven't checked out our last episode, we talk about the circumstances surrounding his assassination, so def do so. In Puerto Rico, cops are beating back activists who are demonstrating against the building of a resort condo pool right on the beach in Rincon. Now, Rincon in Puerto Rico is that sort of place away from San Juan where a lot of the gringos are going and setting up shop because, you know, it's just more of a resort town. It isn't so much San Juan, the big city. So there's a lot of resorts going up, a lot of condos going up, a lot of, you know, these crypto dudes going there and setting up shop. Now, there had been a cease and desist on the construction of this particular resort and particular pool, but then it was amended along construction to continue. So protesters came out, and of course the pigs came out protecting private property and capital and have done what they do. One big thing is that when construction was taking place, they actually found a sea turtle laying eggs, and they just picked up the sea turtle, they picked up the nest, they picked up the eggs, you know, basically put it aside and kept on going. And then there's actual video of the sea turtle trying to come back to its nest, couldn't access it because obviously they're doing construction. And people are out there protesting, police are beating back the protesters, knocking down like construction works onto the protesters and stuff. So solidarity with the people down there. So keep the ball rolling, we'll get into it. Now, Andres, whenever we have our conversations with, you know, people we have on the show, anyone we interview, I always like for them to paint a picture of the place they're from or what they're talking about. So obviously we're gonna be talking a lot about Cuba. So when you personally, when you think of Cuba, what are the images that come to mind? Like, what are the smells? What do you hear? What do you see? Like, just paint us a picture so people understand what we're talking about. Because obviously, you know, we can see the pictures, the old cars, the buildings, whatever. And like, what should people like think of besides what they read on a Wikipedia page? And then from there, just if you could just go into your background and why you think we have you on the show.
Yeah. So, by the way, I am definitely going to want that link to that Soviet, Afro-Cuban guy in the Soviet Union. I really want to see that because those Soviet-Cuban connections are wild, man. A friend of mine, his mother, she's like this working-class woman. She studied in Kazakhstan and learned to make rice piaf from the Kazakhs in Kazakhstan, where she studied how to do textile engineering. So there's all these really wild Cuba Soviet Union connections. I love it.
Internationalism. So,
yeah, exactly. I guess that's actually a good place to leap off of to talk about Cuba, because from the US, oftentimes you think about Cuba and you think the island isolated from the world, like the lost world that has been disconnected, you know, the dinosaurs or whatever. But Cuba's been communicating with all these people for a long time. It's been super international. There is, in the 19th century, you had over 100,000 people come from China as contracted laborers. You have you had people coming from the former Turkish Empire. You had, Cuba is an extremely diverse country. Yeah. Obviously it has European settlers, and it has Africans brought over as slaves, and of course indigenous people, but it was also the place where Yucatec Indians kidnapped from southern Mexico were brought in the 19th century to do the labor of slaves during the Cristeros War. I know a man who one of a friend of the family is actually a descendant of one of those people. Cuba is an incredibly diverse place that has been connected to the rest of the world during this whole thing. Cubans have been traveling not just to places like Eastern Europe, but also to Africa, to Asia. Cuba has been an incredibly interconnected place, and they are very up on what's happening in the rest of the world. They've always been interested in it. One time I saw a group of people coming down. They were dressed, they were painters, and they were talking about Gone with the Wind, the movie.
Oh, no shit.
Professional painters, and they were just talking about that. Like, in Cuba, you'll talk to just random people, and they'll bring up some kind of reference to a book of history, literature, something like that, because Cubans have had the benefit of access to a great education system, not just for people who are normal college age, quote-unquote, but also workers. You have the Cursos para Trabajadores, classes for workers, where every Saturday for free, if workers want, they can enroll for a whole semester and get classes with some of the same people teaching day classes for free. And it's just absolutely great and in that sense. And it's also a place where la gente pasa trabajo. People have a lot of headaches. It's obviously very hot, but and it's got those really, like you talked about smells. I think about the smell of the ocean breeze over the malecón, just that contrast of that salty, fresh air over the malecón and the heat from the sun. But also at the same time, you have people really, you know, figuring out really ingenious ways of to survive despite lots of economic precarity, a lot of scarcities. Some people say dinero se suda dos veces. The money is, you work hard with money 2 days, when you make it and when you spend it, because you got to work hard to figure out where the things you need to buy are. So that's kind of, in short, that's kind of a rambling answer, but that's what I think of in Cuba.
And, you know, tell us a little bit, if you could, about your own background and your connections to the island of Cuba. You know, you obviously are Cuban yourself. You tell us a little bit about your family and your connections to the island, if you could.
Sure. So I come from the Parteras in Cuba have historically crap politics. My line is actually a bastard line. So we didn't actually get money, which helps us not have as crap politics. My grandfather was an accountant for, I believe, Shell. I always confuse it with other companies, but I think it's the Shell company. Before 1959, my grandmother graduated, one of the first Cuban women to get a law degree, and then she became a housewife. But, you know, she got a law degree and she loved to read and write poetry and things like that. And then my family left in 1961. My father's uncle was actually part of the Bay of Pigs invasion. He was one of those who was traded for baby food. That's what the Cuban government did, as kind of just as an FU to the invasion forces. They were like, we're going to humiliate them one last time. We're going to trade them for baby food and medicine. some travel.
Wow.
But he was captured. He was fine. He was able to restart his own business in Florida, and he did well for himself. My family fortunately escaped from Florida because my grandmother hated her mother-in-law and heard that her mother-in-law was coming to Florida. So she hightails it to California as the farthest place she could think of from her mother-in-law, knowing her mother-in-law Edmenia would never follow to California. So they go to California. Instead of growing up in the Florida of the 1960s, my father grows up in the California of the 1960s, the student movements, as Travis, all that stuff. And so that was his kind of political formation. And then he moved to D.C. I grew up in D.C. Eventually went to the University of Havana, where I got my undergraduate degree as a special thing in history, in Cuban history. That's kind of me. I write for various publications on Cuba, US stuff, but
that's really dope. And I want to go back to something you said we were talking about Cuba, because in Puerto Rico, and I'm sure it exists to a certain degree in Cuba, do we have this idea that de raza una, right, that we're from three races one, but from what you're telling me, Cuba's immensely diverse, just like Puerto Rico is immensely diverse. So we try to sort of pigeonhole ourselves into this romantic notion of, you know, three races coming together when, you know, we have Chinese populations in Puerto Rico, we have Arab populations, we have different digits, you know what I mean? And the same thing in Cuba. So it goes to show how, to put it lightly, uninformed a lot of these sort of like mestizaje notions or Latinidad notions are from where we come from. But it's really dope. And some of the smells, some of the things you're saying, again, remind me a lot of Puerto Rico. Because I know every time I get off the plane, it's that combination of the humidity and the salt and, like, you know, just the heat and stuff like that, which is reminds me of home a little bit. But that's really dope. And it's really, I guess, because I'm from Florida. So it's really... it's really funny to me to hear you talk about being a Cuban, being formed outside of Florida, because obviously there's that stereotype of the Miami, South Florida, like Gusano, you know, population, whatever. So that's really interesting. But speaking of which, and speaking about politics and stuff, can you just maybe go into a bit of the basics of like the Cuban political system? I mean, there's nothing basic about it, but obviously I feel like a lot of people have an understanding of it. Can you just kind of dig a little bit deeper for us? But before T, what's up?
Yeah, you know, I just want a quick note. You know, we'll definitely get into what's happening the last couple of weeks, but I think it would be good for, you know, listeners to maybe get an idea of what the Cuban political system actually is like. You know, a lot of people have a kind of all sorts of notions, both, you know, both left wingers and, you know, conservatives have, you know, very different ideas about, you know, what the Cuban political system is. And I think it'd be very enlightening.
Yep.
Sure. Yeah, but empezamos con la candela. we start with the flame, yeah. So I think that the Cuban political system is kind of like there's a lot of explanations of the Cuban political system on paper out there, especially for intra-left consumption. And I think Bad Empanada put out a video on it. Then there's like Azure Goat is another YouTuber is kind of trying to do explanations. There's threads and stuff. But a lot of times the explanations are very much kind of like in the same way that you would explain the U.S. political system to like a middle schooler. It's like it sounds very good on paper. That's not actually how things work. So, for example, I think that let's start with the National Assembly, for example, which is the legislative body for Cuba. It's the equivalent of Congress. It's been a rubber stamp committee for its entire existence, basically. As the Brazilians would say, una ley para que lo vea el inglés. It's so that other people see it. It's not really a body where things really get deliberated. The decisions are made from the top down. And I think that if you talk to Cubans, leftist Cubans who support the government, not talking about opposition, talking leftist Cubans who support the government, behind closed doors, they are not going to tell you that the National Assembly is actually great. There's tons of jokes about grandma. People don't really take grandma seriously. The joke is, if Napoleon had had grandma newspaper, which is the national newspaper, no one would have found out about Waterloo. the Cuban news broadcast, I actually got it down to a formula. It was, production has been increased. The Yankees are bad. Here's some culture. Here's some sports. That was the nightly news. And it's a top-down system whose main purpose is kind of like an armadillo rolled into itself to protect it against any kind of... There's no way to get in, basically. The point is to have the system locked down. The only... The Communist Party is the only one that can really organize and exist on a national level. The National Assembly is massive, so if you really wanted to get legislation passed as an opposition thing, you would have to get hundreds of people elected into the assembly, but you can't organize. So the purpose is to be an armadillo shell, to protect against any kind of political threat. And if you talk to Cubans, you'll get two kinds of responses to justify the system as it exists, which is a very small group of people making most of the decisions with voluntary feedback from below occasionally. Which is one is kind of a more cynical take. Democracy doesn't exist anywhere. Why do you expect it here? Is one take I've heard. So, you know, just let us live. As long as it works, it works. The other take I've heard is a take that actually Eduardo Galeano, who wrote Open Veins of Latin America, really encapsulates perfectly this argument. He has a little mini thing called, he has a book called Mirrors, Espejos, And he has a special little segment called Fidel Castro, or I think it's just called Fidel, where he says, the revolution is not what it wanted to be, but rather what it could be. And for all its flaws, the revolution survived while many other projects did not. That is the defense that many, I would say most of the supporters of the government who I've talked to will give. They'll be like, we want all kinds of things, but this is also kind of, as long as we feel besieged, this is the only way we see for us to survive. This is not me endorsing, this is not me cursing, this is how they defend it to me in private. Publicly, they don't really make these arguments because, like, it's, the optics would be bad. But privately, that is the system. It is, what the government was basically Fidel for many years. He would make decisions from the top down. He kind of chilled out in the 1970s and stopped doing projects because it just occurred to him one night. And it's kind of been more of a council under Raul and Diaz-Canel, who kind of build a who kind of try and maintain the coalition, or what's left of the coalition that was built up in the 60s and 70s. But it is very much a top down system. That's I think that there's not really any other, like, I don't really think other reads of it are viable, really.
Yeah, that's interesting that you brought up Fidel in the 70s, because I think you had tweeted something out like a few weeks ago talking about how, I might have misinterpreted, but how you perceive that the revolution having lasted up to 1976, and then after that was, can you just sort of expound upon that? Like, what do you mean by that?
Oh, sure. So I see 1976 as the end of the revolution, because I think that the institutionalization of revolutions is where you should mark the end. Rhetorically, the Cuban government says this is the revolution. It's also the same revolution since the 19th century. I understand why there's political rhetoric around that. I don't really think I think that's politics. I don't think that's analysis. I think the revolution ended in 1976 because between 1959 and 1976, the government was kind of just doing all kinds of stuff, all kinds of policies and reforms. They tried to do like moral incentives to pay people. We can get into that if you guys want, but there were multiple reasons for it, but it really didn't work. Agriculture was a mess. The economy was going into a nosedive. The Soviets were pressuring the Cubans to conform and using oil to try and bring Fidel to heel, because he was trying to spark revolution everywhere. And the Soviets were like, chill, we only have so many resources. And we don't want to fight the Americans right now. We just want to focus on our internal shit. And so Fidel starts to move towards institutionalization in the early 1970s after the failure of the 1970 harvest, where Fidel cries on television and says it was a failure, it's my responsibility. And in 1976, you get the constitution. Between 1959 and 1976, Cuba did not have a constitution. It had a law that was just under the constitution, but it was phrased in a way where at any given time, any part of this constitution can basically be ignored. If national needs demand. So 1976, things get codified. And by then, basically you get more or less the same system we have today. Some things are slightly different, but you basically have the institutionalization of the organizations, the parties, the broad picture of how the government still works today.
That's very interesting. I'm going to ask you a question then. So you're saying that it's very much a top down system. Are you saying there's no influence from the bottom up at all?
I wouldn't say there's none. And Fidel was famous for, like, he would talk to somebody on the street and maybe they would change his opinion, maybe not, but he could, like, the problem was getting Fidel on the horn. The entire system revolved around him. It was very slow to do a lot of things, but he would walk around places, and if someone said, hey, I've been trying to do this and the bureaucracy won't let me. Fido had said, would bring over his assistant, says, attend to this person and make sure their thing is resolved. So that doesn't mean that there was like, that's a very specific context, right? You shouldn't need to get and hey, you shouldn't need to get the man on the horn every time you need a small thing done. So it was a very hulking, slow beast that was basically built around like Fidel. And you know, Raul basically, the joke in Cuba was Raul no habla. So Raul doesn't talk. He didn't hated speeches. He didn't do the rounds. And you know, a lot of there was a lot of discontent because like I think a really good example is actually so I talked to a Cuban journalist. I was at a dinner party with a Cuban journalist working for Cuban state media, and he told me to contrast Raul and Fidel's rule of styles. He said, one time a story of mine got suppressed, and Fidel called me at 2 a.m. and said, your story is not going to go into the Granma tomorrow, but I want you to know why. I'm going to explain to you why you may not agree with me, but whatever. And so even though you know, this is Fidel still taking the decision, he could kind of use politics to kind of like make people feel at least kind of listened to in many cases, at least among his supporters. And Raul wouldn't even do that. It would just be still be top down, but without any kind of the softness, the personability. There are mechanisms to get yourself heard. But like it's a lot of it is interpersonal connections. Institutions are, I mean, there's even a lot of talks in Cuba about whether or not, you know, should we empower institutions more? Institutions should do more, but they don't end up getting empowered in the end. And so it's still very, very tough.
That's very interesting. And on that note, do you think this was by design from the beginning, or was it something that sort of developed where Fidel was like, and everyone at the top were like, we have to structure our society like this because we have the United States, we have the Yankees there. This is what how we want to set it up. Do you think it was something that developed organically, or did they have this plan from the beginning, in your estimation?
I think that the real answer to that is something that a lot of people will speculate over, but I don't think anyone will really ever have the real answer. Just like, when did Fidel become a communist? Was it
Exactly.
all like in after 19? I don't know. You know, unless we find some documents or whatever, who the hell knows? But I do. It does definitely seem from Fidel's attitude and how he talked. He seemed to have seen him at it as the only way for a project that was going against the United States to survive. Agree or disagree, that was his justification. And not survive as a communist project. I mean survive as a nationalist project. But one of the big problems with a lot of how Cuba's talked about is that it's seen fundamentally as capitalism, communism, that kind of framework. And that is part of it. But the Cuban Revolution is fundamentally a nationalist revolution. And that's part of why the Soviet Union falls, Cuba stays, right? I spoke to this one woman, working class, worked at a cafeteria. Her salary was not enough to provide for herself. So we're talking working class. And she told me, she said, well, she didn't tell me specifically. She said to a group of people, she said, I don't know about communists, but I'm a Fidelist, right? And a lot of people who are kind of, well, communism maybe or maybe not, but a lot of supporters are like, but this is a way to maintain our national sovereignty. And I think that that is key to understanding why supporters of the system allowed it and supported it in the way that it developed.
Yeah, that's very interesting, 100%, because what you see a lot of, especially like really online leftists, talk about how we need to sort of disregard any nationalistic feelings, we need to get rid of all these things, and trying to explain to them that for people oppressed, especially in the global South, like a lot of these movements need to come from a very nationalistic place, right? You look at Algeria against the, like Algeria isn't communist, but their revolution was a nationalist revolution. You see all across the global South, Vietnam was a nationalist, you know, like revolution that they had there, and they just happened to be led by communists. You know what I mean? So it's very interesting you bring that up, and I agree with that 100%. Like at the end of the day, if, because we obviously here on the show, we're very much for the liberation independence of Puerto Rico, but that needs to take place before we set up a, you know, a workers' paradise. You know, that needs to be the foundation of what we're doing. Now, unless T, you have anything else to add or ask about that, I was thinking of maybe we'll move on to like everything that's been going on the last few weeks and how it fits in. So obviously the protests in Cuba, here on the show, like we talked about, obviously we're poorly phrased, but we're fans of the revolution, but obviously we do recognize that there's very fundamental things and very, very legitimate concerns that need to be addressed by the people there. Obviously we're not there. But obviously we have our, you know, doubts of what exactly is the source of all this. Could you just talk about, maybe give us a little bit of back? We did talk about it a little bit, but from your perspective, can you just give us a little bit of background of these protests that have come up the last couple of weeks, where you think they're coming from, what has inspired them, and maybe where do you see this going as well?
Sure. Like, I think that to a certain extent, they're not a surprise because Cuba is currently facing its biggest economic crisis since the 1990s, which is known as the special period in time of peace. So wartime scarcity in peacetime. It was a very bleak period. It is the only precedent for protests like this. A couple hundred people in 1994 took to the streets in what's known as the Maleconazo and protest. And they also chanted Libertad. They also chanted, so it was political demands married to economic scarcity and frustration. I also don't think that it's a coincidence that it happened in summer both times. Because if you have rolling blackouts and it's the Caribbean sun and it's summer and they turn off your lights. So on top of everything, you can't even rest in your own damn house.
Yeah, we see that in Puerto Rico too.
Is it really a surprise that people are... Yeah, exactly. And so what's happened in Cuba in the last decade is things have been getting bad, even though the reforms promised. So basically, Raul and Díaz-Canel, the whole strategy was try to provide, keep the political system more or less as it is, maybe some strategic reforms, eventually very slow, but focus on economic reforms as the motor for growth. And then with growth, you have stuff to redistribute, yada, yada, yada. So kind of like emulate China and Vietnam. That was the idea. Problem. Venezuela has basically collapsed economically over the past decade, right? And that was one of Cuba's biggest economic partners. So that means Cuba's getting less money, and Cuba's not getting, at least on time, oil shipments that it was promised. That's oil shipments that part of that was resold for dollars, part of that was refined for electricity and consumption domestically. So that's one big problem. It's a headache on its own. Add to this, Cuba gets a lot of money from its doctors abroad programs. So medical missions in different countries. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with how Bolsonaro kicked them out of Brazil. The coup government in Bolivia kicked them out. Bukele in El Salvador kicked them out. I don't know if they're back in Bolivia yet, but that's another big source of income. And I think the Brazilian mission was, I think, the biggest one, but I'm not exactly sure. And I think the Venezuelans aren't paying for theirs. Like, I think because of the scarcity, I think there's folks still there, but I don't think they're really paying that much. And I think it's just mostly solidarity at this point. So that's another income stream. COVID basically kills tourism overnight. So that's another income stream.
Yeah.
Trump sanctions on top of everything. And now they're getting lawsuits from the descendants of the people whose property was nationalized in between 1959 and 1961. Another, not just loss of income, but also out the money going out because they have to pay lawyers to litigate cases different properties on the island. A couple of cases have been thrown out, a couple are still proceeding. That's more money lost. And now on top of it, they've also invested a lot in having to vaccinate people. And so that's another, you know, so things in Cuba are really bad. There's short, and then to top it all off, Cuba has been trying to unify its currencies. It has a dual currency system. That's a long explanation. The short version is rampant inflation. And so wrap that all together with rolling blackouts and summer heat, and people took to the streets. It was bad. People were fed up, especially because there was Díaz-Canel is not Fidel. Fidel could say, in Cuba, many Cubans call Fidel el caballo, the horse, because in Charada China, in like the gambling thing, That means the number one. They call him El Hombre, El Fifo, many things. But he had his legitimacy in what he did between 1953 and in the decades that followed. Raul was the brother and he was around. But Díaz-Canel needs to build up his own legitimacy. And that was built on the economic success of his project. Yeah. And that didn't pay out. So it's not really a surprise to me that there were popular protests. I think that on top of the popular protests, you do have a lot of the dissident movement trying to maneuver to get on top of that. But they're trying to ride the wave. I don't think it's possible to actually spontaneously spark a protest like that. Like spontaneously, or no, Machiavelli, do a protest like that in a Machiavellian way and orchestrate it all totally from scratch and totally remotely or whatever. Because if they could do that, they would have done that a long time ago. Yeah. I feel like. And from Cubans I've talked to, in my contacts in Cuba, this seems like a genuine protest thing. It's just that the dissident movement is also successfully co-opting it. And the Cuban government's kind of being outmaneuvered on issues like reforms that even many government supporters are like, yeah, we should totally do that. So.
Now, what are some of the, now speaking of the political reforms, because, you know, you did talk a bit earlier about the system itself. What are some of the political reforms that even government supporters are interested in or, you know, want to see happen?
Well, I mean, many Cuban government supporters have, like, in private dinners and stuff like that, will be like, yeah, we'd like to have more, like, institutionalized feedback and not have to depend on, I'm personally friends with so-and-so who can serve as a back channel to this guy who can serve as a back channel to this person. Like, that's a very inefficient system. And when it's all very in the air, you also have to think twice about if you should stick your neck out on an issue, right? Is it worth it? Am I going to get in trouble? Like, and then, like, there are times when a couple years ago, there was even a Cuban government supporter, I think it was Esteban Morales, who got his Communist Party card pulled, I think. It was some kerfuffle. He's a communist, but he got in trouble for some of the things he was saying, and then they walked it back. But, like, you know, you can be a government supporter and still get into big, big trouble, because it's all about monolithic, giving at least the outward appearance of monolithic unity. And if you break that because no one's listening to you, then you can still get, you might luck out, but you might also get in trouble. And a lot of them just want, a lot of the younger generation just kind of want an institutionalized way to give feedback, to feel part of a project and not just be like receiving orders. Right.
Yep.
And I think that's something. I mean, it's the protests have kind of put a lot of those people in an awkward position where it's like, I agree with you, but I don't think this is the best way. And so that's part of kind of the dynamics and conversations that you're seeing with people like Silvio Rodriguez, who is like their version of, I don't want to say Bob Dylan because he's kind of Bob Dylan, but like like think of. But like, think about like I'm thinking also of Bob Dylan's politics. But like, think about the most beloved figure you can think of, who's just everybody, like in terms of like activism and music or something, like I guess the Joni Mitchell or whatever of Cuba. And even he is taking a kind of, he's still supports the government, but he's taking a very like, hey, we shouldn't treat protesters badly. You know, let's have conversations, more conversations, less like yelling at each other, no violence, that kind of thing.
Yeah, no, 100%. And I guess just so everyone knows how big Silvio is, even outside of Cuba, like my mom, lifelong Republican, she's pro statehood in Puerto Rico, whatever, grew up a massive Silvio fan because it's Silvio Rodriguez. You know what I mean? Like he's very big outside of Cuba as well. Very, very prominent, very, important musical figure in the region. But I guess with all that said, where do you personally see these protests going? Do you think, I don't want to say the government will cave in, but do you think they'll take some of these things on board and actually start to reform some of the things that they're hearing? Do you think it's going to be more of the same, or where do you see this going?
I think that, like, the only honest answer that I can give is that smarter people than me have tried to predict what's going to happen next in Cuban politics at big moments, and they've gotten wrong and look like idiots. So I'm just going to try and avoid their fate. So I don't know what's going to happen, but I can at least say how the game is set up right now. What are kind of like the forces at play? So, with the protest movement, right now I think that it's a mistake to see it as a homogenous thing. What, like, think about any protest movement in the United States or anywhere else. If people ran spontaneously take to the streets, this is not one party taking to the streets, but people spontaneously. You're going to have hardline dissidents from the right. You're going to have liberal dissidents, which is another thing that's part of the problem the government is facing the last couple months, is liberal dissidents have been making inroads where hardline conservative dissidents had not. And then you have a lot of just people who are just unhappy because there's shortages. And then there's this guy called Díaz Canel, who I never voted for, you know. And so, you know, you have this evolving thing, and the experience of the protests is also going to shape their opinions. And I think it's a question of who gets to ride that wave, whether or not, you know, who gets to kind of co-opt that specific protest movement and kind of shape where it goes and see if they can shape it into a long-lasting feature of Cuban politics, or if it's just going to fizzle out. One thing that the government has been very good at doing for a long time is infiltrating the fuck out of every dissident. Sorry, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to use that word.
Absolutely. Please.
Infiltrating the fuck out of the dissident movement and then flipping them or like exposing them and doing things like that. That's what happened in 2003 with the Primavera Negra, where a bunch of dissidents were arrested. I remember Richard Gott's book says that journalists were whispering, that's my source. And he was actually a government, like a double agent. Like, what the hell? Like, you know, the government has been very good at doing that. So who knows? The government may be able to, from within, using its state security, may be able to defuse it. But I think that it's a really question of, it's an evolving protest movement. We got to see where it goes next. I mean, in 2 days, we actually might see something because that's the 26th of July. So that might be more protests, maybe not. Who knows? I think that things are really bad for the government right now because all those same problems that existed on July 11th are still true. Plus, the U.S. is even more interested in what's happening in Cuba. And, you know, we know about some of the new sanctions, which seem mostly like paper sanctions from Biden, thankfully, so far. But at the same time, you know, there's a quote attributed to Martí, the most important in politics is what you don't see. So, you know, we don't really see everyone's cards, so I don't really know fully what the U.S. is doing right now towards Cuba. So they're very isolated, in a very bad economic spot, and a lot of the goodwill they would have gotten from a more, like without these protests democratizing on their own, they've lost a lot of the opportunity to get that goodwill, and now they're in a strange, very strange position where they have to basically do a war for hearts and minds in terms of rhetoric, and they're not very good at that. The media is very good at like doing like not getting themselves in trouble, but they don't really have a good charismatic media apparatus to really change the opinion of people on the street. They're very clumsy. Gotcha. About how they do messaging and PR, and it's something that there's actually a doctoral thesis that I know of at the University of Havana's journalism school specifically criticizing that. So this is not just me saying this, that exists, and it was awarded an A. So the government is in a very tight spot, and I don't know how it's going to wriggle out of it. I don't see the government going super, super, hopefully not super, super, super hardline. When the protests broke out, Díaz-Canel said, estamos dispuestos a todo. We are willing to do anything. And people were like, whoa, man, chill. Yeah. Don't throw gas on the fire. You know, passions are high. That could get, you know, that could hurt people. And he's kind of backed off of that. But the government is in an unenviable position for what it does next. And it's about to get in, it's involved in a domestic political debate for which it's not doesn't really have a lot of experience. And then what Biden does, I have no idea. Like, he's at the same time saying he's putting paper sanctions on, or largely paper sanctions, And he's saying, we're going to do more, but at the same time, he's saying, we're going to restore remittances, potentially, and also restaff the U.S. Embassy in Cuba. And I'm not sure if he has a policy. Like, it still might be information. So I'm really not sure what happens next. What I do know is things were brought to a boil, but they're back to a simmer. They are not extinguished. Yeah. I think that it won't take a lot to get something similar to happen in the future. So, you know, wait and see, I guess.
So speaking of the United States, you know, there's a lot of debate in the U.S. You know, people insist on kind of having a position on the, you know, internal affairs of Cuba, especially talking about intra-left debates. How should people in the United States, left-wingers especially, view, you know, the ongoing issues in Cuba, you know, the good and the bad?
That is an excellent question. And it also puts me in a difficult spot because it is a very, very, very complicated question. I'm not sure if I have a right answer, but I can try and explain my position and how I see things.
That's all we ask.
Yeah. So I think that the embargo is a big, very big problem, and we should definitely try to get, I don't think it's going to get totally eliminated for many, many reasons, but I think that there's a strong moral argument for easing as much of, removing Trump's sanctions and easing as much of the embargo as possible for humanitarian reasons. I think that objectively speaking, whether or not you agree with the Cuban government, these are sanctions that affect the Cuban people. It is affecting, Cuba imports over 60% of its food. Some calculations some years go to as many as 70 or 80%. And given that, these sanctions are a threat to the ability of people to feed themselves. I think that there is a very strong moral argument for that. At the same time, I do not think that the position that we should not recognize that, for example, there was excessive force, there's video documented excessive force by the police. When the protests broke out, there were groups of government supporters with sticks. I don't mean little twigs. I mean palos, big ass, like not baseball bats, but something like it. There's documented excessive force. There's a lot of summary trials going on right now. Some of it under what's called the ley de desacato, which is the disrespect law, which is basically for disrespecting the authorities and national patriotic symbols, you can get that is a criminal charge. A lot of places have abolished that. Cuba keeps it on the books. And I don't think that it is... I'm jumping the question of whether or not it's the ethical position to be quiet on that. Because I think that I'm not going to convince someone who thinks differently on that. I don't think it's the pragmatic and strategic position of the left to be entirely quiet on that, because if we're entirely quiet on that, no one is going to take us seriously. I think the question should be, who is our audience? Is our audience each of people who already agree with us on 99% of the things, and where we need to have the most perfect message for this relatively small leftist audience? Or are we trying to convince people who have eyes and ears and aren't dumb? You know, we need to be able to say excessive force against anybody is wrong. People should have a right to protest. They should. The U.S. government also shouldn't be embargoing these people, and they shouldn't be involved in the domestic politics of these people through regime change, secret funds of I think $20 million a year or something. So, you know, I think we can take both positions, but I think it's pragmatic to recognize basic facts. I think it's a question of audience.
Yeah, 100%. I think what you're saying is it would behoove us to recognize the internal contradiction that exists there and to talk about it and to actually try to address it instead of just, you know, we must at all costs support the Cuban Revolution, you know, regardless of whatever, which I think is the position of us here on the show. Like we've always said, you know, obviously we want we're in solidarity with the people in Cuba, but at the same time, there are contradictions there that need to be ironed out 1,000% if the project is going to succeed and if the people are actually going to get what they need, what they've been promised, and what they deserve. Cool. With that said, one thing that's always fascinated to me, and like if you know me, if you know us here, everyone knows that we're very, very proud, you know, Boricuas, very proud Puerto Ricans. I know in terms of leftist movements in amongst Puerto Ricans, the El Partido Independiente de Puerto Rico, like which is the Independent Party of Puerto Rico, a lot of the leftist parties there and groups, you know, Cuba, I don't want to say Cuba's the model, but it's always a very strong critical support for Cuba, for Fidel, for the imagery, for everything that's going on there. There's a famous line, de un pájaro la dos alas. So like from one bird, the two wings, you know, how we have that cultural connection, you know, that's we're like kindred spirits. Can you talk a little bit to that? Like what is, I guess, the sentiment in Cuba? Like, is there an act of like, yeah, we must, you know, help our Puerto Rican brothers? Because I think because Austin talks about it as well, that I think Fidel has this quote where he was saying that as long as there's one Puerto Rican asking for independence, we have a moral obligation to support Puerto Rican independence. Can you talk a little bit about that and like the sentiment in Cuba or amongst Cubans generally?
Sure. Like, I mean, in Cuba, of the Cubans who I have talked to about this, there's been strong support for Puerto Rican independence as kind of a matter of course. I mean, Cuban Puerto Rico's relationship goes all the way back, of course, to the 19th century. The Puerto Rican flag and the Cuban flag have the same origins, that's why they're so similar in color, and why people keep them up on Twitter and computers.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, Fidel used a political capital and influence to try to get the Puerto Rican independence fighters who attacked Congress in the 1950s freed. So there's long been a sense of support for the decolonization. That's definitely the framework used of Puerto Rico from the U.S. There's actually the Tricontinental magazine, which is now since defunct, though I think they've rebooted it, I think in the UK or something. But Cuba's Tricontinental actually had pro-Puerto Rican articles, independence articles, and like posters and stuff. They were spreading in the U.S. and it was being circulated in leftist circles in the U.S. in the late 1960s, early 1970s. There's this one book I read by Anne Garland Mahler that talks about one of these posters in San Francisco and stuff like that. Like this is Cuba's not just rhetorically done things and done things behind the scenes, but also has, you know, used a lot of its media to try and promote the cause. And I mean, there's also a lot of family connections between the two. Not everyone went to Florida. My father's cousins went to Puerto Rico, and he still lives in San Juan, the guy who was named after Andres, not to give a surname, but he moved to San Juan and had his daughters there. There's just the sense that it is there are deep, profound historical connections between the Cuban and Puerto Rican people.
Yeah, wow, that is fascinating. I think that at this point we might put a bow in it, unless you have anything else you wanted to ask, Leroy.
I think maybe going forward, what are the lessons you want people to take away from what's going on in Cuba? What in your estimation, what is there to do? People organizing outside of Cuba, outside of even Latin America, like within the, you know, the U.S. empire, what can people be doing in the streets? What sort of organizing can they be doing? Like, what could they be doing outside to support the people there?
That's a very good question. I think that there's donating to the various donation campaigns, trying to get syringes to Cuba. Right now, there's a really bad COVID outbreak there. And the big problem is lack of syringes, and a bunch of syringes, I think £1 million worth, so like probably like $2 million worth of syringes were just sent or just arrived, and more are coming. But this the Cuban shots vaccine is very good, but it takes three shots. So three shots by 11 million people, also spillage and all the rest, you're looking at 33 million syringes at least. So given all that, I would, yeah, strongly recommend that. Another thing that I think would help, and it's the easiest thing in the world because it's a thing to not do, is don't antagonize people who have potentially bad takes on Cuba on Twitter. I don't mean like the hard right-liners who are like just jerks and just say like let's bomb Cuba. No, those jerks are jerks are a different issue. But I mean like well-meaning liberals who have different premises and preconceptions and all the rest. Don't antagonize them because many of those people are potential allies in trying to push against like sanctions. Like the many liberals for different reasons are anti-embargo to some degree, even if they are not fans of the Cuban government. And I think that it would behoove us to not alienate them, if that makes sense. And just generally write to your, I mean it's trite, but write, I'm not sure what else to do other than write to your congressperson, say it matters to you. Like try and work, leverage power how you can, whether even if it's only at the local level, because the man, these sanctions are going to kill people. I mean, they are killing people through shortages of medicines and things like that. And we gotta lift that so Cubans can have the also not just eliminate shortages, but like not just be able to live, but also have the political space to maneuver to deal with their own issues domestically without this meeting.
Yeah, and you know, to your point about writing to Congress people, I think some city councils have passed resolutions also in favor of ending the sanctions and also in favor of like establishing their own ties with people in Cuba, which again is one form of like if you're you know if you are someone who engages in electoral politics in kind of engaging the US system, that is another route you can go besides, lobby your Congress people obviously, but try to pressure your city council too. There's a lot of maneuvering there as well.
Yeah, 100%. And especially if you're from outside of Florida, because I grew up in Florida, and I don't see Marco Rubio being pushed on the issue. I don't see Rick Scott being pushed on the issue. DeSantis, I don't see any of them being pushed on the issue because a lot of Cuban Americans in Miami hold a lot of political capital, a lot of political sway. So especially those of you who live outside of Florida, do what you can. Contact your congresspeople and your local city councils and push these resolutions, because if you get enough of them, it can sort of sway and move the political conversation and conventional wisdom of what's going on there in the correct direction. But Aceri, Andres, thanks for coming on the show. A lot of fun. Yeti?
Oh, I was just gonna say, you got stuff to plug, man?
Oh, true, true, true.
To plug. Well, I mean, you can follow me on Twitter at AS Peritira, because there's a guy who's a Puerto Rican actually who also has my surname, who has my name, and who has taken my at Andres Peritira Twitter account curses. And the other thing is, I do have a Cuban history podcast, the Orígenes, a Cuban history podcast. So please give that a listen if you have a chance. I'm slowly, work very slowly, working my way through all of Cuban history from the Taínos all the way, hopefully, to the present at some point. So, yeah. And thanks again for having me on. It was a lot of fun.
No, it was beautiful having you on, man. Amazing. But definitely check out his that podcast. Again, that's another connection to the Taino connection as well. I have my Taino tribal tattoo as well with the coqui. So definitely check that out. Stop laughing, guys. It's I'm proud of it.
No, I'm not. I'm smiling, bro. I'm happy for you. Shit, man.
Yeah,
Always thinking I'm
no.
making fun of you
I don't know,
because you're a
man.
queen subject.
I guess because I live in the Commonwealth. Anyway. This is dope ass conversation, especially very measured, very good, very like I know personally, I know T as well. Like definitely things to take away from this and sort of, I don't want to say mold, but definitely things to introduce to our conception of the region and of Cuba and of our own politics as well. Definitely better perspective to what we generally have. Because again, like I said at the top, like it's very easy to get lost in the imagery and the romance of like, you know, the El Granma and the, you know, going through the Sierra Maestra and the Sierra, yeah, through the mountain ranges of Che, Fidel and all these people. But to actually talk about what has eventuated from that, I think it's super important to understand where we need to go from here. But like I said, if you enjoy what we do here, you want access to the Discord and have conversations with us, have access to the book club and all that good stuff. And just generally support what we do here about bringing awareness to anti-imperial global South Latin American issues, consider becoming a compa oficial by donating to our Patreon. Follow us on Twitter, on Instagram, on TikTok, and all that good stuff. Again, follow and check out all of Andres's good work. And with that said, see y'all next time. Y hasta la victoria.
Later, y'all.